ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, Glads and Pods. Philip Adams here with the little wireless program coming to you from Gadigal country. Shortly, Ian Dunt will drop some of his depth charges into the murky waters of British politics, and then we're going to soar to the heights of Olympus as classicist Natalie Haynes will tell us about her new book, Divine Might, which resurrects the Greek goddesses. So often they've been, well, overshadowed by their male counterparts, but as we will learn, those goddesses were, well, complex and powerful women. But first, off to the old dart for our fortnightly date with Dunt. Ian Dunt is, of course, our regular commentator on the UK political scene and a columnist for iNews. Ian, we've talked about the Rwanda bill for what seems, well, like years. Has it reached the end game? What's the latest?
Yeah, it's passed, basically. I mean, it will get royal assent in the next 3 days, but last night, over a really epic series of battles between the Commons and the Lords, the last stages were finally reached and the bill passed. It's a depressing morning. It's a really grim, grim morning in any number of ways, constitutional, moral, political. It's not even just about the brutality of the measures on refugees in the UK who would have arrived here thinking this was the kind of place that they could get safe haven before being forcibly removed to an African dictatorship. It's also about the constitutional damage that we're doing to the country in the process. Because, of course, this followed from the Supreme Court in Britain saying Rwanda was not a safe country to send refugees. What this bill does is essentially say that Parliament can overrule the courts, that whatever Parliament says is true becomes true by virtue of it saying it. They could just as easily say that black is white and that dogs can fly. It is essentially the giving up on any kind of normal constitutional function for the judiciary, a really profoundly dangerous moment for British liberal democracy. That bill is now absolutely going to get royal assent because it passed through the Commons and the Lords.
Now, Sunak says no ifs, no buts, but there are plenty of critics and opponents to the plan to offshore, spawn boat arrivals in Rwanda, some even from within the Tory party.
Yeah, there's plenty of Tory discontent. You know, where the trouble is that it's not in the House of Commons. And the origin of all this is the Brexit fight. There was a point in the middle of the Brexit wars where Tory moderates stood up and went, look, we're not going to accept no deal Brexit. We're not going to accept the most extreme example. And Boris Johnson, who was then the Prime Minister, purged them from the party. He essentially purged the moderate wing of conservatism, we call it One Nation conservatism, from the parliamentary party. And since that happened, there has not been any real resistance from the more decent element of conservatism within parliament. So all of the opposition that comes from conservatives is in the House of Lords. You take someone like Ken Clark. Ken Clark, he was the Chancellor when I was growing up, proper old kind of Thatcherite fiscal conservative. But he believes in old-fashioned conservative ideas like the rule of law and the idea that you shouldn't have the government just come and dictate what courts are and are not allowed to find in their cases. So on that basis, he opposes it. And there are others like him. But, you know, that is ultimately a minority voice. When you look at the people who claim to be on the sort of centre-right of politics within Parliament, they barely raised a squeak of opposition. Only two Tory MPs, just two of them, honourable though they might be, but only two of them were able to resist their party when it came to this bill in the Commons.
On a related matter, what about the Afghanis who helped the Brits in the fight against the Taliban? Are they exempt?
No, what a pertinent question that is. There was an effort by Lord Brown to have them exempt, to basically say anyone that was connected to ARAP, which is a particular kind of scheme for those who were formerly helping Brits, in other words, that they were employed by African army to help Brits, that they should be exempt. The government said that it accepted that amendment after weeks of fighting it, but refused to do so in the bill itself. It just said, look, we promised that we won't do it. Now, I don't want to be paranoid, but I have to say that this government's promises are not worth the paper that they're written on, and they haven't even bothered to put it on paper. You know, this is a government that is establishing a bill which is based at its heart on lies. I mean, the purpose of the bill is to say Rwanda is safe, but we refuse to do any of the things that would make it safe. It is fundamentally a deceptive bill. So when a government of that nature comes along and goes, oh, sure, you know, believe our promises, but we're not going to put it down in the primary legislation, you think, no, absolutely not. You are demonstrably deceptive human beings. But even if that were to be true, it ignores the vast majority of people that helped Britain in Afghanistan, because most people that helped were not employed by the Afghan army. They were employed in a variety of different areas. For instance, you know, in the judiciary, female judges, human rights campaigners, teachers, journalists. These were the kind of figures who helped. Now, when Britain evacuated from Afghanistan, those people were almost completely ignored. They were given very, very little help. They were left at the mercy of the Taliban, despite all of Britain's promises about democracy and liberalism that we would bring to the country. Now, they're not even included in what is being discussed here. So in actual fact, those people who helped this country, if they managed to escape the Taliban and make it to Britain, will now be sent packing to Rwanda, unless they happen to have been employed by the Afghan army, and even then on the basis of assurances, which we should be frankly very sceptical about indeed.
Now, under this plan, if that's the word to describe it, how many are expected to be relocated to Rwanda? I understand there have been some, 6,000 small boat arrivals this year alone, Ian.
Yeah, and to give you an impression, I mean, look, we have 83,000 people on the asylum waiting list. These are basically people whose claims are just simply not being processed. You know, not being processed because the idea is that we'll send all of these people to Rwanda. So what's the point of even finding out whether they are asylum seekers or not? Just keep them in this kind of Kafkaesque, bureaucratic half-life where they're not entitled to any, you know, to go to work or to any real income, waiting for their claim. Rwanda's capacity is about 400 asylum claims a year. I mean, the plan itself is so obviously insane, so obviously muddled and ineffective, that it's extraordinary that it can just pursue its way through Parliament without even the press really pointing out just how manifest its own inadequacy is. So we don't think they have the capacity for it. We're not certain that the government can charter the planes, although they think that they've chartered enough flights. They're currently in the business of just some of the most obscene moral squalor of training officials to be able to manhandle refugees onto those planes in order to get them to Rwanda. So really, there are a lot of structural problems and incentive problems as to whether they'd be able to deliver this.
Older listeners may recall a time when Australia was trying to cut a deal with Cambodia, of all bloody places, you know, to send some refugees there. It was grotesque, ludicrous, and immoral, and here you mob are echoing us yet again.
Doing the exact same thing. You and I have spoken about this many times before, but there is an obscene kind of conveyor belt between Australian anti-immigrant and anti-refugee policy and the take-up in Britain. It is, and I'm sorry to say this, this will not please you, but you know, you can point to a country like Sweden, for instance, in British debate, and generally what Sweden represents is, you know, generous welfare policy. So you'll always say, if you're trying to make that case, you'd be like, well, more like Sweden. And when it comes to Australia, the primary totem, the primary symbol is draconian refugee policy. And this has been transmitted into Britain by, you know, also a variety of Australian figures like Linton Crosby. You know, or you could actually say it in a slightly more nuanced way by people like Rupert Murdoch. You know, that aspect of Australian politics just comes funneled into Britain and has done for several decades now, since at least John Howard, that attitude has sort of been adopted. Britain's done exactly the same, by the way. Rwanda's just the only country that took the offer. offer. We were going around, cap in hand, desperately trying to get other countries to do it. Costa Rica seemed notably outraged and offended that we should go there and talk about their country as somewhere just to dump problems that we've decided we ourselves
cannot be bothered to face. I didn't realize that they went shopping.
Oh, they went shopping and just got no customers. You know, the only place they could find was Rwanda, a dictatorship, somewhere that we know is unsafe. And we can demonstrate as unsafe by the fact that we grant asylum to Rwandans when they get to the UK. You know, there are successful Rwandan asylum cases all the time in this country. So again, you sometimes feel like you're going completely insane. The evidence for the fact that Rwanda is not safe is so obvious, so palpable, so black and white, that you have to have an insane political culture to have passed a bill that insists that it is safe.
Ian, explain to this ancient broadcaster why Rishi has invested so much in this policy. What's the risk and what on earth is the reward?
That's a horrible story, really. But it starts with Boris Johnson. You know, this was originally Boris Johnson's plan. It was kept up by Liz Truss in her blink and you'll miss it administration and is then pursued by Sunak. And it was never meant to work. It was meant as one of Boris Johnson's culture war wedges. You know, he knows that, you know, liberals in the city, university educated, generally think you should be nice to immigrants and asylum seekers, will hate it. And his target demographic, which is probably about 25% of the country, who are basically just very passionately and aggressively anti-immigration and anti-asylum, will love it because it sounded tough and brutal and like a kind of moral collapse that apparently some people feel the need to associate themselves with. So he pursued it for that reason. Now, at that point, Rishi Sunak knew it wouldn't work. He was the Chancellor in the Treasury at the time, and he said, well, this is just completely insane. This is just a terrible use of money, which it is. We've spent hundreds of millions of pounds on this thing so far in order to deport zero asylum seekers. Now, Rishi Sunak becomes leader. He thinks, well, I have to appeal to the right of my party. I have to have something I can say to the country as to how I'm going to stop the boats. So on that basis, this policy became what he follows. So he now has strapped himself to this policy completely. There's even an extent to which the election timeline is dependent on when he thinks he can get at least one flight into the air. He thinks, if I can get one flight into the air, it'll show to the country that, you know, I'm trying to do something about the small boats problem. In actual fact, what he's done, and this is the tiny bit of reassurance you can get from the absolute disaster that we're watching right now, is strap his own political credibility and his electoral chances to a plan which will not work, which was never designed to work, and which he himself knows cannot work.
Any further hurdles, obstacles, legal challenges?
Just practical matters. Can they get the planes? Can they get the cases? There are legal challenges that are still just about possible under the bill, but they have been narrowed to the point of being certainly extremely unlikely. It's about each individual having to show why that in their specific case, perhaps due to health, perhaps due to mental health, they would be unable to be sent to Rwanda. We would expect most lawyers to use mental health in that capacity. I mean, they will launch those initiatives. But really, the bill has been very carefully written to exclude legal challenge and certainly to remove the European Convention of Human Rights, which Sunak now describes as a foreign court, from the process. So I think it's hard for us to stop it. I think probably he will succeed in what he says he's going to do, which is by July to get planes taking refugees to Rwanda.
Now, Labour comes to power at the next election. This is a very likely outcome. What happens then?
They will repeal. They have said this very, very clearly now and on multiple occasions. They will repeal. They didn't fight this thing to the end because they think that you can't really fight things in the House of Lords if it's got a majority in the Commons. I think that's completely wrong. I mean, it's constitutionally illiterate. But nonetheless, they didn't fight it to the end. However, they will repeal. And their policy is primarily about putting money and resources and staff into the asylum processing system and then working internationally to try and stop the boat. So it's a much more sane and responsible approach than the one that we're seeing from the government.
Would you do me a favour, please, and get me an autographed copy of Liz Truss's new book?
Absolutely not, because then I'd have to buy it and pay her money, and I absolutely refuse to do that. There are many things I would do for you, Philip, but pay money to Liz Truss is absolutely not one of them. Her book was released this. I don't know if you've seen some of the coverage of it. It is quite shocking. I mean, there are moments she's desperately trying to court the American Republican sort of deranged right-wing lunatic market. And so it's appearing on Fox News. And even then, she's unable to satisfy even really rudimentary human behavior. There's one point where she gets a moment to promote the book, picks it up and shows them the back cover, turns it over, then shows them the front cover the wrong way around, turns it around, finally gets it right. And you think, wow, that's an extraordinary thing. All you were asked to do at that moment was to pick up and show people a book. And you still managed to make two really quite severe errors in that 1 second period, which in its way is indicative for both the contents of the book and the manner in which she conducted herself when in office.
Lovely to chat, and we'll have to leave it there. See you in a fortnight. Our regular commentator on UK politics, Ian Dunt, columnist for iNews. And this is LNL. And coming up next, we put the Greek goddesses back on the pedestal. Not so long ago, beloved listeners, we heard from Australian writer Anna Funder on the powerful ways that history has made women invisible. In that case, her example was George Orwell's wife, Eileen O'Shaughnessy. Now we wind the tape back a few thousand years to the time of the ancient Greeks to take a closer look at some of their more misunderstood goddesses. Our guest is writer and classicist Natalie Haynes. Natalie has been called a very modern classicist for her work in bringing the Greek myths to a wider audience through fiction, non-fiction, even comedy. In her new book, Divine Might, Natalie reclaims and reimagines the stories of deities who have been reduced to stereotypes and to bit parts. Natalie, let's begin by you doing a riff on what you mean when we create gods and indeed goddesses in our own image.
Right, so there's an ancient writer called Xenophanes who said, I mean, it's an extremely radical statement if you're a not religious person like I am, for example. He says that if oxen and horses and lions had hands and could draw, their gods would look like oxen, horses and lions. So this is, you know, a really early iteration of the idea that people create gods in their own image. And the point that I wanted to start the book from was this quote from Xenophanes, and to say, okay, well, if almost all writing that we have from antiquity is by men, and it is, then does that affect the way that we see deities in the past? And would we look at goddesses a bit differently if we had a more balanced view of who they were? And so I tried to find a modern example of something, a sort of a set of deities that might have been created by men. And I lighted upon superheroes in the 20th century when, you know, Superman and Batman, I know he's not technically a superhero, and Wonder Woman and Batman's many nemeses were being created. And it seemed to me quite clear that what you saw was sort of strong and powerful men. And then if they were desirable, sexually desirable, that was a secondary issue. But for female figures in the world of comic books, they tended to be sexually desirable first, and then their powers seemed largely secondary. And so I wondered if I could examine goddesses from the ancient world with a similarly kind of interested but critical eye, and see what might have happened in the way those goddesses had been interpreted through the years. So what I found was that, for example, if you look in modern translations of almost any author about the goddess Hera, she's almost always presented to us as a horrible, vengeful, vicious, shrewish, awful woman, like the world's worst mother-in-law with revenge on her mind at all times. And then that seemed to me slightly at odds with the idea that the Temple of Hera at Samos, which doesn't survive to us today, was three times the size of the Parthenon. And, you know, I know I'm speaking to Sydney, which has a pretty recognizable skyline itself, but I would say the Parthenon has had the most recognizable skyline for the longest time, 2,500 years of any city in the world. So imagine a temple three times the size of that. Could this really be a goddess that people didn't like?
We'll circle back to this extraordinary character a little later, but let's make the point, or your point, that Greek gods and goddesses were in general rather poorly behaved.
They're very badly behaved. The idea of gods and goddesses being benevolent is a later invention, I would say. And it kind of makes sense if you remember that for ancient Greeks, gods and goddesses sometimes fulfill a role as a representation of the natural world, and they also sometimes fulfill a role as a representation of what we would consider to be a psychological state. So as an example of the former, why is the god of the sea, Poseidon, also the god of earthquakes, so malevolent? Well, if you've ever been caught in a storm at sea on a tiny little Greek boat 2,500 years ago, the sea probably does seem quite malevolent to you. If you've lost your home and loved ones in an earthquake, it probably seems pretty malevolent there too. You don't need a nice deity to describe the natural world if you don't have science to describe it yet, and they don't. You need a capricious one, because that's often how the natural world can seem. And as for psychological states, we tend to consider things to be internal if they are, for example, love at first sight. You know, if I walked into a room and saw a beautiful and handsome man, and then I immediately fell in love with him, we would probably say that was on me. You know, that was my mind going into the room, interested in meeting someone. If we were quite passive aggressive, I suppose we might say it was his fault for being so gorgeous, but that's a different issue. I don't think we would tend to think of it as an externally supplied force, which for the ancient Greeks, it absolutely was. Aphrodite, or sometimes her son, Eros, could simply afflict you with desire for someone you couldn't have, for someone you didn't like. All these things were perfectly plausible to the Greeks. So to us, that might seem like a really good way of getting rid of responsibility for having behaved with extreme foolishness. But for the Greeks, it's just a way of defining the world.
So Greek gods are raped, they murdered, they demanded child sacrifice. They weren't nice to be near.
No, not necessarily. Certainly not for the children in the sacrifice, I think it's fair to say. But I think, you know, we need this sense of there being a power that you could placate, or at least you could try to placate, if we have a time before, the children is a really good example. A third of children in ancient societies wouldn't have made it to adulthood. So you know, tragedy was absolutely around people at all times. That's
well, you make the point that they
is so short.
Sorry, you right? made the point that Greeks lived in a world of famine, of plague, of disease, and yes, high
right.
child
I mean,
mortality.
Childhood diseases weren't invented, you know, by us. They existed perfectly well 2,500 years ago. Getting born was really dangerous. If you made it to about 5, you stood a reasonable chance of making it to 12 or 13. But then as a boy, you might well be needed to fight in a war. And as a girl, you would very possibly start giving birth to children before your body was ready. So these two things were incredibly dangerous. And that's not just our estimation of it. It's in Euripides, where Medea says she'd rather fight 3 times in the front line of battle than give birth to a single child. She's explicitly comparing the two in terms of mortality rates. So if you live in that sort of world, and they did, then of course it makes perfect sense to have a god, Apollo, and a goddess, Artemis, who can suddenly take the lives of children, because you need to find a way of at least believing there's a possibility that you could make an offering to this god or goddess and keep your child safe. Because why would people in the past have loved their children less than we do? It must have been a terrifying time to love, I would guess.
My guest is Natalie Haynes, author of Divine Might, Goddesses in Greek Myth, published by Picador. And as you can hear, Natalie is a very, very accomplished broadcaster. Now, the gods and goddesses were, in your words, immortal and immensely powerful, with the emotional range of a toddler deprived of its favourite toy. Tell us more about this.
Yeah, it's a really interesting feature that I didn't really imagine until I started writing fiction, actually, with these gods and goddesses in, which is all the time back in, 2019, 1,000 ships, I think, which is that if you live forever and there's no possibility of that changing, then nothing has a great sense of importance. So we see it in, for example, the Iliad, where Zeus is really upset that his son Sarpedon dies in the, spoiler, Trojan War. But it doesn't bother him as much as it might bother a human person, because he's going to live forever. He's always going to see his mortal offspring die. How can he not? That's sort of baked in to being their father. And so what you see is that they have absolutely no sense of proportion whatsoever. So quite a small slight, as we might perceive it, takes on exactly the same quality of rage inducement as a gigantic life-shattering event might. So not being awarded a golden apple for being the most beautiful goddess means that enmity can be directed at the entire city of the man who didn't award it to you. And so what you see in the Iliad is Hera and Athene, although the golden apple isn't specifically cited in Homer, it's in our later sources. And they persecute the Trojans with all the vigor of people who have been personally, physically traumatized by every single resident of Troy, when in fact they just didn't get given an apple. It's like, okay, well, you know, I'm sure you've seen a toddler with the same, and it's not, you know, from the inside, it's obviously really distressing to experience that quantity of rage and trauma, but there is something faintly comical about it if it's provoked by something like, you know, not having a blue spoon when you wanted that and you've got a red one instead.
So here we have Artemis, the arrow lover, goddess of the wilderness, of animals, the hunt, nature, childbirth, and care of children. Heavens above.
It's a lot, isn't it? She's got a lot on, Artemis.
She's wearing many ancient Greek hats. Now,
I'll say,
it's hard to pin her down. She's been described in so many ways. She's a bit like interpretations of Hamlet.
I think that's really true. And actually, this is because the Greeks used to do a thing, and indeed the Romans used to do a thing called syncretism, in which when they met a new society, they would try and match their gods and goddesses to the gods and goddesses that this society had. And you see it happen a lot with Artemis, where they are slightly kind of awkward fits. It's a little bit easier if you're matching, you know, king of the gods, Zeus, thunderbolts, being in charge. That, you know, I think every society they encounter has a king of the gods, you know, so they don't particularly struggle with trying to match those up. And a sort of nurturing mother goddess, similarly, not too difficult. A goddess of love and desire, not too difficult. But Artemis is so many different things, and some of them seem really contradictory. So she's the goddess who protects young girls, but she's also the goddess who may demand their sacrifice, or at least her priests tell us that she demands their sacrifice, which I suppose isn't quite the same thing.
And she's the queen of animals, wild animals.
She's the queen of wild animals.
Yet she hunts and kills them.
Yeah, I found this really problematic. But then a friend pointed out that I've been vegetarian for 36 years and I might just not understand what it's like to live somewhere where there were dangerous animals. And I was like, oh, yeah, no, that's a really good point. As far as I realised, you know, from, I don't know, from the 1980s onwards, I think of animals as things that need being protected from humans. But that's because I grew up in Birmingham in the Midlands in England, and there's nothing dangerous there at all. There's like the biggest thing is like a fox. So of course and then you see them getting run over and you're like, oh my goodness, the fox. So of course that's how I think about it. But obviously that's not true if you live in ancient Greece, where you could be gored by a boar, as happens to Adonis, who dies of it, spoiler, Odysseus, who doesn't die of it. You could be, you know, ravaged by a lion. You could be bitten by a snake, as happens to poor Eurydice and indeed to Philoctetes. So you know, the natural world was really dangerous. I don't think I have to tell you that, Australia. And so it was perfectly sensible to want to be outdoors in the wild and trackless places like the goddess Artemis, but also to see hunting as part of that. That might, you know, not fit my values, but I'm not in ancient Greece, so that's as it is.
Let's now circle back to Hera, who you say is the goddess that everyone loves to hate, except
so true.
You don't.
I don't, because although she does many awful things in Greek myth, and she really is the most relentless persecutor of people who simply don't deserve it, she is also, I think, a woman who lives, a goddess who is most representative of the women who worship her, right? So she is really representative of her constituency, essentially, which is married women. She is in the ultimate patriarchal relationship, as of course women were in ancient Greece. They didn't have a vote, they didn't have any freedom, they had male guardians, first a father, then a husband. If their husband died, they would revert to the guardianship of their father. They were never free citizens. And Hera has a very similar existence in lots of ways. She's the wife of Zeus, and that's how she derives her status as queen of the gods. But he is a violent and aggressive and coercive and unfaithful partner to her, and explicitly violent. We hear in book one of the Iliad, Hephaestus, who is Hera's son, the blacksmith god, says to her, you know, if you're going to go against Zeus's wishes, we're going to have to do it in secret, because the last time you stood up to him, he hurt you. And when I tried to intervene, he hurt me. And they're not talking metaphorically here. They're talking literally. You know, Hephaestus has been rendered lame by being thrown from Mount Olympus by the god Zeus. And the thing that Hera doesn't have, that the rest of us would have in her situation, is the prospect that, you know, on the best day, he might die. She's stuck in a coercive relationship with someone who will live forever. And if she were to try and leave him, she would fail because he's more powerful than her. And also, you know, all her status is derived from being married to him. Who remembers Zeus's former wives? Who remembers Metis? Almost no one.
Okay, so let me get my tiny mind around this. She's Zeus's sister and wife.
Yes, I'm afraid values on incest have changed dramatically in the time since the ancient Greeks built their gods. And so, yes, she is one of six, I think, siblings. So that's Zeus, Hades, Poseidon, Demeter, Hera, and Hestia. So there are six siblings, and yes, yes, she is married to her own brother. Yes.
And
they grow up separately.
And she's stuck.
A lot less beauty.
She's stuck in this eternal relationship with Zeus, who's a really shabby husband.
He is. Shabby is absolutely the word. Yes. He is always trying to seduce other people. He assaults them and rapes them with absolute impunity because he is the king of the gods. And there's also a sense, which I noticed when I was writing her chapter in greater detail than I had before, that he tends to find people who sort of remind him of her, but in a sort of more extreme way. So she is often described as Boopis, so ox-eyed or cow-eyed, so having lovely big brown eyes, essentially. So what does he do when he falls for Io and he worries that Hera will find out? He turns her into a cow. It's like, you can never be enough of the things Zeus wants. And yes, of course, he is always turning himself into animals or occasionally showers of gold in order to sexually assault women. So he is just a thoroughly sordid man.
Natalie, how did she morph into the comedy trope of the bossy wife?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting shift that happens through time, is that as women get more status and the right to vote, for example, which is still a really quite recent one in historical terms, then the idea that they're fully trapped in these relationships, however accurate that idea is, there are plenty of people all over the world who are still trapped in forced marriages, then we tend to think of it as being less of a common issue. And so the idea of the deeply frustrated wife becomes one of comedy rather than of tragedy. And so what we see, I think the most extraordinary kind of version of Hera is probably Prunella Scales as Sybil Fawlty in Fawlty Towers. And of course, majestically, her name is Sybil, which gives her this idea of ancient mysticism. She obviously performed in the least mystical way possible.
I wonder if that occurred to John Cleese.
I would just like it to go on record that Basil is, of course, the anglicised version of Basileus, God, king of gods, rather, king. Basileus, king. So it's there if you want to see it.
I shall never look at Fawlty Towers in the same, in the same
Don't
way.
Don't ask me who Manuel is. I haven't got that one yet. I'm working on
you
it.
You will. You'll Hermes. Get there. Now, what does all this suggest about sexism in ancient Greece? Was it uniformly misogynistic?
It's certainly misogynistic by our standards. It's not always as misogynistic as I think we think it is, because sometimes the misogyny that we're seeing is a later generation of misogyny from classical reception times, so from the Renaissance onwards, I guess. And so you often see huge power and status allotted to a goddess in antiquity, the goddess Hestia, for example, who doesn't appear in a lot of narratives of ancient Greek gods and goddesses, but she is absolutely central to Greek homes. So her name, Hestia, means a fireplace, a hearth. And we're told in the Homeric hymn to Hestia that she has a central place in every home of people and every home of gods, i.e. temples. So everywhere that has a hearth, everywhere that has a fireplace, that's a shrine to Hestia. She's absolutely everywhere. By the time she's in ancient Rome, or more specifically Pompeii, she's become the goddess Vesta, and there are shrines to her all over Pompeii. And yet we've somehow forgotten her. Why is that? Well, I think there was probably not much appetite once Christianity was on the rise for a kind of almost invisible goddess who's present in every home. It would have seemed a little bit too threatening, I think, in lots of ways.
But if we look back over the millennia, there's a spectrum. And, for example, tell me what was going on in Sparta, where women had a much more open, outgoing life.
They really did, at least by our standards of what that would entail. So they had a much more public life. They were allowed outside without, you know, living in just women's quarters. This is something that we see in 5th century Athens, where essentially if you were a working class woman or enslaved, you might well be out in public. But if you were a upper class woman, you would be cloistered. So you would only be in the women's quarters. You would never see men who were anyone other than your father or your husband, perhaps a brother and obviously a son. The Athenians were obsessed with the idea that they might inadvertently raise the child of another man. All their laws, seem to be kind of, and indeed their plays, look at Oedipus, this anxiety, this paternal anxiety is right at the core of 5th century Athens. Whereas in Sparta, they have no such anxiety, it seems. Their children are brought up communally. Spartan women might, if their husband is a bit too old and infirm, find themselves a second husband to, help them out. I suppose the issue that we have here is that we don't have any of this writing from Sparta, and certainly not from Spartan women. All the records that we have of Sparta are from basically non-Spartan, Athenian often sources, who have an interest in exoticizing the Spartans. So how much of it is true and how much of it is there? Oh, you'll never guess what these weird people do. It's really hard to call.
Now, let's move on to another horror story of a myth, and that involves Persephone and Demeter. Tell us their story.
Yeah, so Demeter is the mother of Persephone. Zeus is Persephone's father. And Hades, who is sibling to both of these people, to both Zeus and Demeter, does a sort of secret deal with Zeus that he should kidnap and traffic Persephone and take her to the underworld, and he'll enter her into a forced marriage. Now, that language is quite strong, but the reason I use it is because you can find these values and these sentiments in ancient literature. So, for example, in the Homeric hymn to Demeter, which is just beautiful, we see the language of force being used. So Persephone is kidnapped by her uncle Bia by force. She is unwilling. She's taken unwillingly. She's shouting and screaming to be let go. It really bothers me that this is a narrative that's acquired a sort of patina of romance in recent years. It's not romantic. It's a forced marriage. And Demeter does absolutely not what her brothers assume she will do. They assume, I think, that she will just accept it. She'll accept that her daughter's been taken to the underworld and she'll never see her again. Because what else is she going to do? She's only the god of, you know, agriculture and stuff. What could she possibly do? Well, the answer is she'll grieve. And she'll grieve so hard that nobody can grow plants, that nothing will grow, that no one can be sustained. There can't be a harvest. She causes a famine for a year. And we're almost on the verge of being wiped out as a species. Zeus sends every god and goddess he can think of to go and intercede with her. And she refuses. The only thing she wants is Persephone back. And so eventually he gives in. He sends Hermes to the underworld to tell Hades he's got to release Persephone. And Hades says, yes, of course, take my chariot. Don't worry about that at all. He pretends to Hermes, again, this is in the Homeric hymn to Demeter, that he's doing exactly what's been asked of him. But what he's actually doing is force feeding. And again, the word is quite clear in the Greek. He force feeds Persephone a pomegranate seed so that she has to come back to the underworld every year. She's not told what the conditions are. She's not told. And anyway, it would make no difference. He forces her. So that's why we have spring and summer, which is when Persephone returns and Demeter is full of joy, and autumn and winter, when everything dies, is when Persephone must go back to the underworld. So she gets half a victory.
Talking to Natalie Haynes, author of Divine Might, Goddesses in Greek Myth. Now, you identified with Persephone as a young woman, but now you appreciate the power of Demeter.
Yeah, I think this is one of these real shifts that happens. I looked at some modern poets' versions of this story, Evan Boland and Alicia Stallings' poet, A.E. Stallings, and Carol Ann Duffy. And I thought, how interesting. This is an observation that that they are all, or were all, in the case of Evan Boland, mothers of daughters. And I think you encounter this story when you're young. So, of course, you associate yourself with the child. And again, Persephone is a literal child. The verb used in the Homeric hymn is paidzousan. She is playing like a child. It's the root of words like pediatrician. And so you associate with the young person in the story. As you get older, of course, you start to see the other version of it. I dedicated this book to my parents and the dedication to my mother specifically. I said she would give Demeter a run for her money. And that's absolutely the case. You know, my mother would indeed starve a world if someone messed with her daughter. And so I think as I've got older, my desire to see men stop being quite so appalling to younger women is it's a burnishing flame, let's say that.
For decades, for generations, the classics were dominated by men. Then along came Dame Mary Beard, who's been on the programme on a number of occasions. What influence did Mary have on the field?
Well, specifically on me, she was my lecturer when I was an undergraduate. She lectured me in Roman history. And most specifically, I probably shouldn't tell this story, but she probably won't mind because she is quite, you know, racy in these matters. I don't think she'd mind. I studied a paper under her, which was called The Roman Emperor, Deconstruction and Reconstruction of an Image. And as part of this paper, we all went in for lectures on whatever morning it was each week. And then one week, my scientist friends were all going off to be in labs for like 8 hours. And I was going off for a lecture, which consisted entirely of watching the porn film Caligula. And all my scientist friends were going, how is this? How are we getting the same kind of degree? I don't know. I'm sorry. My degree turns out to be in watching odd porn. Mary was, of course, a huge influence on all of us because, you know, as a student, what you saw was this person who was absolutely not bound by authority, and specifically a woman who wasn't bound by authority. And of course, she's an incredibly authoritative professor. She knows so much about so many aspects of the ancient world. It's just extraordinary. But she has also opened so many doors for so many younger people, as she's thought about doing.
But you've found it hard to get some of those doors open. I know you you struggled to get your early novels published.
Yeah, and everyone was sorry now, huh? Sorry to sound smug and everything, but wow. So, yeah, no, it took me a long time to find a publisher for The Children of Jocasta. I changed agents and editors, publishers over The Children of Jocasta, and because people thought there wasn't a market for it. It just seems ridiculous now. You know, when I did the interviews for Stoneblind, which came out in 2022, I think. Yes, let's say that's true. I'm terrible at modern time. I'm only good at ancient years, really. But when I was doing the interviews for Stoneblind, someone said, you know, so obviously it was always going to be a huge success because, you know, women in Greek myth. I'm like, oh, I wish I'd had your crystal ball. In 2016, when I was trying to sell Jocasta, nobody thought there was a market for it at all. And, you know, then you watch the books go rocketing up the bestseller lists. You know, at one point, Pandora's Jar, which is the sort of prequel, I suppose, to Divine Might, it's about women in Greek myth. It was number two in the New York Times bestseller list, a book I literally couldn't get them to buy because they thought nobody would buy it. So, yeah, I'm sorry I can't stop laughing, but the whole thing is slightly insane. It's like, oh, yeah, no, I always knew that my feminist revision of Greek myth was going to be an international bestseller. It was written in the stars. But, yeah, anyway.
You are perfectly entitled to laugh. And I'm surprised. I'm surprised you laugh so lightly. It might be imbued with vengeance, but
I've had my vengeance upon them all. I'm sure they will feel slightly vexed now.
In introducing you in this conversation, I did mention in passing that your work as a comedian. Now, you're no stranger to male domination of spaces. Tell me about the predatory male behaviour you encountered on the comedy circuit.
Oh, you know, the 1990s were a time, I'm afraid, of predatory male behaviour, and as is all time. But I think the 1990s had a particularly toxic combination, although I may only think that because that's when I was young, if you see what I mean, of a sort of ladette culture, which basically said women can hang out with boys and behave as badly as they want, and also an absolutely no consequences culture still for men who behaved appallingly. So it was women formed when I started stand up after I graduated. So it was about 97. Women were 10% of comedians on the stand up circuit in the UK. When I left a decade later, it was about the same. You know, there was, if you went to those comedy courses where people start out learning to be a comic, it would be about 50-50, male and female. But by the time you got onto the circuit, the women would just have fallen away. And, you know, it wasn't, at least according to the people who were teaching them, it wasn't because they weren't as funny. It was because the atmosphere was so profoundly toxic. And, you know, I'm still...
Natalie, we all know that women can't be funny, but...
Oh, my goodness, the number of times I heard people say it who would never have said the same thing about race or sexuality. And I was like, how do you not see how, okay, well, I mean, if you genuinely don't see that that is just an appallingly prejudiced thing to say. I honestly, you know, I spent years answering interview questions exactly like that. We all know women can't be fair. I was introduced on stage once by a guy who said, and this is a pretty well verbatim introduction. He said, ladies and gentlemen, you and I all know women can't be funny. Here's one who's going to try and prove us wrong. And then he looked at his hand where he'd written my name and wrote and read, Natasha Hugh. That was the introduction. So now when I turn up to do a gig for like a book festival where you have some incredibly professional interviewer and they're like, how should I introduce you? I always say, do you know, it really doesn't matter. I've had worse. You can literally walk on stage, fall over and say, you've never liked me. I will still have had worse. So really go for your life. Whatever you want to say, it's fine.
Now, listeners would be furious if I didn't finally talk to you briefly about the Furies.
Oh ho, well, we couldn't allow that kind of fury on their behalf because the Furies are such interesting goddesses. We see them as these sort of, they start out as kind of vengeance spirits. They're just personifications of vengeance. But they are more specific than that and they develop through antiquity.
So they become a really specific kind of punishment for if you have done a terrible thing to someone you're related to by blood, usually. So the most notorious appearance of the Furies is that they chase Orestes, the son of Clytemnestra, who has killed her. They chase him, you know, they threaten to chase him to the ends of the earth. And then in the third play of Aeschylus's Oresteia trilogy, the whole thing is taken to Athens and turned into a courtroom drama, because there is no dissuading them. If you behave in a way they perceive as being morally wrong, and they are moral absolutists, so there are no exceptions, then they will chase you to the ends of the earth until you die. That's just what they'll do. It is like an actual horror movie. Specifically, it's like the film It Follows, I think, but that's a separate issue, perhaps. And I felt very strongly as I was writing this chapter that I don't love the lack of nuance, but I do love the moral clarity, because it felt to me as I was writing it that it was just constant, the sort of drip, drip in the news of politicians saying, well, I never said this. Well, I never promised that. And, you know, somebody, an interviewer would present them with video evidence of them saying it. And they just say, no, I didn't say it. And I thought I would really like a revival of the notion of shame when you had done something wrong, or guilt when you had done something wrong. And at the very least, I'd like us to acknowledge that not everything is relative. It's not the case that you maybe, you know, could have been misinterpreted as having said exactly what you actually said. So I found myself slightly wishing for the Furies, keeping a few people a little bit more honest than I felt like they had become.
I don't know about the Furies, but I've been talking to a force of nature in Natalie Haynes. Natalie's book is Divine Might, Goddesses in Greek Myth, published by Picador. And note this, beloved listeners, Natalie will be appearing at the Sydney Writers' Festival in May. Thanks, Natalie.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that, beloved listeners, is the show. Now, on our next, as the tensions and conflict in the Middle East continue to rage, is there any hope for the two-state solution? Yossi Beilin and Hiba Husseini say political solution for lasting peace is the only path out of this violence. Husseini is a former legal advisor to the Palestinian Peace Process Delegation. And Beilin is a former Israeli justice minister who indeed helped devise the Oslo peace process in the 1990s. And the pair will discuss and outline their proposed new peace plan for the Israelis and the Palestinians. Their idea is for a Holy Land Confederation. How would it work? And does the current dire situation offer an opportunity? Oh, and with Anzac Day on the horizon, Elizabeth Caden discusses her new documentary on the little-known role of the Greek island of Lemnos. It's a story of multicultural mateship involving Indian, Sikh, and Gurkha forces who fought alongside the diggers. That's in our next edition of LNL. We'll see you then. Thank you.
listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.